From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. It's not news that the Cape Fear region suffers from some of the highest numbers per capita of people addicted to heroin and opioids. In response to what's now commonly called the opioid crisis, law enforcement strategies have changed, with officers carrying the anti-overdose drug naloxone and authorities looking to put more offenders into treatment instead of jail. At least one North Carolina advocacy group, NC Harm Reduction, passes out clean needles, doses of naloxone, and information to people with addictions. No judgment, no requirements. Wilmington Mayor Bill Saffo convened a legislative task force 2 years ago to address the problem. Just last week, local leaders announced the Cape Fear Opiate Overdose Quick Response Team. This brings Coastal Horizons, a local resource and counseling center, together with first responders. If the pilot program is successful, it could be replicated in other cities. But today, we're coming at the opioid crisis from a slightly different perspective. Earlier this year, North Carolina researchers published a paper in the Journal of Addictions and Therapies that shows one genetic marker, methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, or MTHFR, present in 90% of their patients who struggled with opioid dependency. The same researchers found marked improvement by giving patients a specific cluster of B vitamins. Joining me to explain all this is study author Dr. Andrew Farah, chief of psychiatry at the High Point Division of the University of North Carolina Healthcare System. Dr. Farah, welcome back to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel. It's great to be back.
Great to have you here. And we're inviting you to join the conversation. Have you struggled with an opioid dependency? Have you found a treatment that you consider effective? Call us and tell us about it on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. As a psychiatrist, Dr. Farah, help us understand first why you went after this one particular genetic marker. What was your first indication that perhaps methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase was an indicator of this propensity to addiction?
You know, it's such an important marker for so many other neuropsychiatric illnesses. And there had been other links to addictive illness, even alcohol and so forth, but there was only one study that considered it in a very specific population when it came to heroin and opiate dependency. And it's our population. You know, when I we have a ward with 28 beds, 28 psychiatric beds in the triad, and it seemed that goodness, when I started there, you know, 20 years ago, we would have some detox patients, but now at least half of our psychiatric floor is heroin opiate detox on any given day. So it truly is an epidemic. We're losing, what, 4 North Carolinians a day will die from overdose from synthetic or heroin or some type of opiate. So we just decided to look at that population and screen for this gene that we knew was prevalent in other conditions, and that's why the study was designed to exclude those people. If you had a primary diagnosis of depression, well, we know that, you know, it's over 50% of those folks have this marker. We're not going to include you. You had to be just addicted to this compound.
So that marker came, the fact that it was linked to depression or linked to dementia. You've even suggested autism. That
right.
had been studied previously and identified.
Correct.
And so you said, is it possible then that this marker is also an indicator of a tendency towards this kind of addiction?
Exactly. And when we look at other, the role of genetics in other addictive illness, and you just, you know, whether it's, you know, cannabis, alcohol, so forth, it seems that the role of genetics is the most prevalent, at least 31% of the player in the addiction to opiates. So of all the addicting compounds, the genetic risk is highest with opiates. So it was a natural thing to look at. And we have, and sadly, we have no shortage of patients to look at.
In this case, you say that you studied 96 people and you found that 90% of them had this particular genetic marker. Just from a study point of view, isn't less than 100 people kind of a small pool? And do you need to replicate this study before
you talk about the conclusions?
Right. You're absolutely right. And we are continuing it on. You know what I mean? So as people come in, we're going to gather more data. But in fact, the first 30 patients who came back positive, I phoned the lab to make sure they were not sending me the same report over and over because I just couldn't believe that there were 30 in a row that came back positive. And sure enough, it held up. But you're right. It is a small sample size, but it was so high. And again, as we carry it forward with another, I shouldn't let the cat out of the bag completely, but, you know, if you just double those numbers, the numbers do hold up. Yeah.
So this mutation, MTHFR, you
yes.
say the key word in that is folate. What
yes.
is folate, and how does it factor into the equation?
Right. We know folate is a B vitamin, and we've known it's important to our functioning for a very long time. In fact, they fortify bread with folate, right? It's very important in prenatal vitamins and development and so forth. But B vitamins come into the body as what we call prodrugs, and they have to be metabolized down to various forms that the body can use. So just to give raw folate, it's important, or dihydrofolate is dietary folate, or folic acid is the supplement. But the brain in particular needs a methylated form of folate, and that takes four steps of conversion, four enzymatic steps, and that last step is by this enzyme that's methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, basically MTHFR, and that is the gene that codes for it. So in very shorthand terms, this marker is a gene responsible for the last conversion to folate to make that folate the form the brain needs to carry out numerous reactions in the brain. There are various mutations. Some are very mild and some are more severe. Some of them compromise the functioning of that enzyme up to 70%. So it's functioning about 30% of what it should be producing. But there are over 40 different types. We just test for the two most common types. But even though somebody may come up negative for it, they may still have a type we don't test for. And when we realize, well, you know, it's related to depression, it's related to dementia, let's just give everybody the metabolized folate, those studies did not hold up. They held up a little bit. But what we learned was that it's really seen as a flag in the ground to say, hey, there's a genetic problem here, but there's also a variety of others that coexist with it. It rarely exists as a single mutation. So there's probably other B vitamin mutations. And I describe it like an enigma machine. Remember from World War II, there's a preset code, somebody punches letters in, and a whole other code comes out the other side. Well, our preset code is our own genetics. The environment acts on it, and what comes out the other side is illness or good functioning or poor functioning for certain things. And that's different for everybody and from person to person. So when a patient is in front of me, they may have the MTHFR, but they may also have a B12 mutation or another mutation for tyrosine hydroxylase, another enzyme or something. Or they may have four others that we didn't test for, and just their MTHFR may be very mild. So we don't know that exact genetic risk. But the good news is we can circumvent pretty much all of them by giving all of the metabolized versions of those vitamins. So not only giving the metabolized folate that the brain can use, but give it the fully metabolized B12 and the B1 and the B3. So that's why we treat, when we see MTHFR, we see that one marker, we can just flood their system with the metabolized folate, but it makes more sense to give all of them to circumvent all the possibilities that are out there.
Now, have you studied the effectiveness of giving people those B vitamin clusters?
In depression, we have. And we found that we got a 42% remission. Okay, so of the people that came to us with major depression, we gave them the cluster of the B vitamins. 42% of their depression was gone within a month. And then at the end of the study, for the other folks who did not respond, we will double the dose and capture some more folks. With addiction disease, that's just ongoing, and it's kind of early to tell. This is so much more multifaceted sometimes, because people come in with multiple drugs of abuse and multiple comorbidities and so forth, and whether or not they go to rehab or not. You know, we just don't have an answer for these people, and that's why I thought this was a nice study, because at least it gives us some clue as to the genetic vulnerability is something we can address.
But when it comes to the treatment, you're not saying the B vitamin cluster is absolutely the way to go. We haven't shown
yet. We've not shown that yet.
Okay.
Correct. Now, I think it's a tool that helps you if you're devoted to your recovery. But many of these people do well with that, with rehab groups and with drugs for cravings and drugs for depression, you know, that kind of thing. So everybody is very unique. And like I say, we don't have the answer for these people. It's, as many people know that struggle with addiction, it is a revolving door. And the elephant in the room is, I can't tell you the number of people that come in the ICU, they've just overdosed and they've literally been brought back to life twice or something. And they say, well, I don't have a drug problem. And I say, you were dead. Don't tell me you don't have a drug problem. Well, I want to leave. You know, they're craving the drug. Yeah. You know, William Burroughs wrote in the 60s when he wrote Naked Lunch that, you know, junk or heroin is the ultimate product, because you don't sell the product to the customer. You sell the customer to the product. And when they're sold, they will crawl through the sewer to get it. And we see that level of craving and in this illness that's just unparalleled.
Have you studied the impacts of these B vitamin clusters on dementia?
Yes, we have. And there are certain compounds you could even prescribe based on that.
These are prescriptions. This is not over the counter. I'm going to try some B3, some B9,
right,
some B12. You have to get it in prescription form.
That's correct. There are some that are medical foods that are prescription, and there are some that you can get that are very similar, that are over the counter or on the internet, that are not prescription. So we can go over those and the specific names. The most exciting one, we did a study a few years ago where we took the B12, the folate, and an antioxidant, and we were able to take people who had very early dementia and do a PET scan, show the PET scan findings of the temporal and hypo, you know, the temporal lobe and parietal lobe hypometabolism, and in 6 months reverse that and show that the PET scan was now normal. And so we advise, there's a new capsule now that we can go, we can list these for your audience if you want at the end, but there's a capsule that combines the B12, the folate, the N-acetylcysteine, and omega-3, some curcumin, some microdose lithium. And the idea is you give it to folks who are at risk for dementia, and it may protect them from developing dementia or slow the progression of it.
So are you working with other researchers on this issue? Because this is,
It's very exciting, isn't it? Yes, we have... we've been asked to do a study on this particular tablet for early dementia and just, do a placebo group and just follow these folks, do their neuropsychological testing before and after, do the PET scans before and after. So, yeah, it's very
exciting. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. We're exploring the role of one genetic mutation in tendencies for opioid use disorder, depression, dementia. We're talking about treatment options. When we come back from this break, we'll hear from some listeners. Tell us what you think by calling us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can send an email to coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, it's a look at the genetics of opioid use disorder, possible treatment. With us today, Dr. Andrew Farah, Chief of Psychiatry at the High Point Division of the University of North Carolina Healthcare System. And we want to hear from you on this Thursday. Have you struggled with opioid use disorder or had a family member who has? Give us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. Dr. Farah, I wanted to bring up Mark's email. He wrote, "My family has been rattled by this enemy of our society for the last 10 years. All three of my sons have been addicted to opiates. Thankfully, they are all off of them today. One way we are making a difference," he writes, "one of my sons and I opened up a recovery home called Prodigal Recovery. September will be our first anniversary. I'm passionate about helping people fight this battle. My latest effort is to publicize wristbands as a way to open a door that is otherwise all too often closed." He writes about raising awareness by having some kind of visual signal that would identify someone as being involved in recovery, whether they're a person recovering themselves, whether they are connected to someone who is. But the idea is, I guess, it would destigmatize it and also open the door to people who are looking for help or
That's
information.
That's a fabulous idea, and congratulations on their recovery and your efforts, because you're absolutely right. Sometimes that recovery community is all that keeps people well. It is a, now the model doesn't work for everybody. Some people don't want to be part of a, you know, they're more seclusive and so forth. But that is the strength that many people have to stay away from it, to change their context, you know, contacts and so forth. I mean, we have many people that go out of town to go to rehab. You know, they just have to get out of that environment. And it is really, like I say, we don't have all the answers, and that's a wonderful piece of the puzzle that this wonderful person is providing for us.
And one of the things he points out, I think, with the mm-hmm. wristband is this idea of stigma. Do you right. run into that in your, you know, as you're working with patients? And do people still see addiction as some form of character failing or a lack of self-discipline?
You do see that, and you also have the mental image of sort of the skid row alcoholic, but that is, we just have that in the back of our minds. At the same time, the reality smacks us in the face that it affects all socioeconomic status and all. In fact, if you look at that study, what was bizarre was our typical patient was the majority of these patients were female, and they were all like in their 20s and 30s, and they were all fairly smart. You know, these were, you know, people you'd see walking around Wilmington look like a college girl or something, and that was what was so unusual to me. These weren't like, you know, homeless junkies. These were intelligent, attractive, smart people from nice homes, and that was like our typical hospitalized patient for heroin dependency.
Did they also have a typical story as to how they became dependent?
Usually, it was exposure through friends, and then what people don't understand is that some drugs. For example, a patient told me that he tried cocaine. It didn't do anything for him, but about 20 minutes later, he didn't feel any effects, good or bad. And 20 minutes later, he said, "Y'all got more of that?" And what the drug had done was induced craving, even though he didn't have a euphoria. So a lot of these drugs upregulate receptors so immediately. You know, the closest thing most, you know, like I remember I was grabbing a bunch of candy the other day and it tasted so good. I was grabbing for more candy while there was still a bunch in my mouth. You know, there's sort of this idea that your body begins to crave something almost instantly. And that's why it's so dangerous. And, you know, cannabis now is equally dangerous in a lot of ways. And people don't, they think it should be legalized. And I'm happy to be the old fuddy-duddy that says, no, this is a terrible thing to be legalized, and we should re-stigmatize cannabis use, marijuana use, because we admit every month we're admitting one or two people age 18, 19, 20 who have first-break psychotic illness, and they're daily cannabis users. So 15% of our schizophrenics are schizophrenic because they decided to use cannabis from age 16 to 20.
What percentage?
Well, it's been estimated 10 to 15%, but I go with the higher number to scare people. You know, I say if you like.
You're saying, wait, I just want to make sure that I'm understanding
yes.
this.
Yes.
You're saying that people who have used cannabis from their adolescent years into
yes.
for how long do you see this effect?
Usually, you can see it after one use of synthetic or high potency cannabis. Usually the high potency or synthetics are the worst, but usually it's like that four-year exposure where there's a particular genetic cluster in about 15% of the population. They expose enough cannabis to that genetic predisposition, and it's classic epigenetics. The environment changes the gene expression, and I can't tell you the number of stories we have, you know, young male, young female, whatever, comes in with new-onset bizarre behavior, hallucinations, paranoia, drug screen positive for cannabis. Parents say, yeah, they've been addicted to it for 3 or 4 years, and now they're schizophrenic. So the British Journal of Psychiatry was at 10%. More American authors say 15%. But it's something people don't talk about. And in the 60s, in the 70s, and even in the 80s, the cannabis was 3% THC and 1% cannabidiol. So when people say, well, I thought it was medicinal. Well, yeah, cannabidiol is one cannabinoid out of 80 toxins in that plant. One of them that has therapeutic value may make your nausea go away, may block dopamine receptors, may help you in some way. But that's bred out of the plant. It's 0% cannabidiol now and 8 and maybe 20% toxin.
So you're saying the medicinal component
it's
isn't
not in the plant.
In there
it's not
anymore.
In there. It's been bred out. You know, so like.
So then, what do you say to people who are using medical marijuana in places where that's legal?
Well, they're hopefully getting cannabidiol predominantly. They're getting that version. They still get the same warnings, and we do see psychotic reactions on that. And I will also tell people, you know, you'll meet the miracle story where they say, well, this is the only thing that worked for my nausea. And I can tell you, I've participated in enough studies where I've seen miracle cures for depression and hypertension and all sorts of things that were placebo pills. So, you know, one or two stories doesn't really convince me. But people need to know, like this, if you're out there doing, if you're particularly, the teenage brain is very vulnerable. So please don't do cannabis. Please don't do marijuana. You're putting yourself at risk for a permanent psychotic disorder. In fact, 6 times the base rate if you're a cannabis smoker. And in fact, if you're a regular cannabis user, 76% of our schizophrenics report some use of it.
Okay? I think that's going to be shocking to a lot of people. You said this has been published in medical journals.
But we don't talk about it. Yeah, for some reason, the medical community is kind of silent about it.
And there is this perception out there that if you're going to do illicit drugs, well, marijuana is probably the least risky.
Right, and it's not at all. In fact, some patients develop a syndrome of derealization after just one or two uses where they're in a permanent state of deja vu and they can never really get back. It's very bizarre. So they have continual derealization where things don't seem real. And 30% of people do get addicted to it. So this idea that it's safe. I tell people, if you like going to the movies and there's 100 seats in that theater, and there's 15 of them have a grenade under them, are you still going to go to the movies every day and take your chances? And that's what you're doing. You're just playing Russian roulette with your brain when you use cannabis daily.
Okay, you keep dropping these little grenades. So you just said 30% of people get addicted to marijuana.
Correct.
You're saying that 30% of all the people who smoke marijuana become addicted.
Well, of the users, yeah, 30% would be addicted. Yeah, it is an addicting compound.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about genetic mutation that could be responsible for the tendency towards opioid use disorder, depression, dementia. With us today to talk about his study, Dr. Andrew Farah, Chief of Psychiatry at the High Point Division of the University of North Carolina Healthcare System. Tell us what you think during this live discussion on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. Mark from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. Very interesting discussion.
Thank you.
And as I was writing down the email address, I heard you reading the email that I sent you the other day. And
you are the founder of Prodigal Recovery?
Yes, ma'am. My son and I.
Oh, how wonderful. Congratulations. That's wonderful work.
Well, thank you. And we were talking about the marijuana. He was a very heavy pot smoker before he got into the harder drugs. And I'm sure it has something to do with where he is today. But thank God that, he had enough and that we were able to turn a very negative situation into a very positive one. But I don't want to take a few time in talking about our recovery home. We are very happy to be doing that. But this is very interesting about this vitamin B compound that not only would I never attempt to spell, I can't even pronounce.
Right.
Well, I think the giant word that we've been batting around, that's the genetic mutation.
Correct. Yeah, it's all related to folate metabolism. And I can list some products if people want to hear. The best one is something called Enlyte, E-N-L-Y-T-E. And that was the one we based our study on for depression. So this has B1, 2, 3, 6, 9, has all the B vitamins and a little omega-3, and you can get it online. You can just go to enlightrx.com, and there's a version that you don't need a prescription for, and it has vitamin D in it as well, and that's called Enlight D. There's also another pill called Serifolin with a C, Cerefolin-NAC. And the NAC stands for N-acetylcysteine. And why that's important is that's a compound. So this compound has B12 and folate, but it also has the NAC, which has been shown to reduce cravings for cannabis. And it's also the best antioxidant you can put in the brain. So if you have somebody using marijuana and they stop, it would be great to take N-acetylcysteine or NAC. And if you just take N-acetylcysteine, it's an amino acid, like taking a protein pill over the counter is $12 a month. And a good omega-3, particularly at least 600 milligrams of DHA in the omega-3, because we have a study where people have become psychotic from their marijuana use, and we're trying to prevent them from staying. We don't want them to stay psychotic. We're trying to see if we can reverse that. So we give them the reduced B vitamins, we give them the N-acetylcysteine, and we give them a good omega-3, because there's evidence when people begin to show the signs of schizophrenia, if you give a good omega-3, you may reduce the conversion to permanent psychosis by maybe a third.
Mark, thank you so much for your call. And we're going to post some of this information on our website. I just want to make some sort of clumsy legal disclaimer here.
Check with
your doctor before you take any of these supplements or adopt any kind of new regimen. no one is able to diagnose during
exactly.
a call-in talk show.
Exactly. And the good news is everything I've mentioned is natural. Everything yes. is so. We're not talking about pharmaceuticals, which is good news.
What are the possible side effects of upping your dose of B vitamins? Are there any negative side effects or risks?
You know, the good news I can tell you, in our study, everything was a placebo rate. So even when we doubled the dose, we, you know, the rate of nausea and all those sorts of things. Now, there you will see evidence that people say, well, if you just flood the system with folate, you may increase the risk of cancer. Where that comes from is they did do a study where they literally gave 2,000 milligrams of folate, and there was a decrease in the efficacy of natural killer cells, part of the immunity that fights cancer. We're talking about a very small percent of the metabolized folate. So we have not seen that in our studies where there was increased events of carcinogens and so forth. So,
and we are getting some reaction to your statements about cannabis being addictive.
Always do.
I bet you do.
Yeah.
So first I want to read Nathan's email, and then we're going to go to Brian from Wilmington. Nathan says, addiction, this is not the problem with opiates. They kill from overdose. No one ever died from a marijuana overdose.
Well, there is marijuana toxicity and there is psychosis, and 60% of people who are arrested today in Atlanta will have cannabis in their system. So there are people that are not calm on it. They're actually violent on it. So at the minimum, the police departments in major cities that keep statistics, the minimum you'll see is 35 to 40% of people have cannabis in their system at the point of arrest. So my warning about it is that it will now if you've used it and you're continuing to use it and you're 30 or 40 years old, fine. Do what you want to do, but don't pretend it's safe for the adolescent brain. It's not safe for the adolescent brain. That's where we see the conversion, and I can guarantee you that anybody who has a lifetime prescription of clozapine or risperdal, they would rather trade anything for that schizophrenia. You know, it's a bad illness to have.
Brian from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure. You object to what he says about cannabis.
Very much so, and I got to say, I feel like we're going backwards in the whole debate. The demonization of cannabis is one of the main factors that led to the crisis of opiate abuse and hard drug abuse that we're experiencing in this country right now.
How do you make
cannabis
that leap?
Cannabis is not 30% addictive. I'm very curious.
How do you make the leap that
information?
Yeah, I'm going to stop you. How do you make the leap that the stigmatization of cannabis led to opiate addiction? I don't understand that leap.
I mean, it's been pretty well studied. The DARE program equated cannabis and heroin since the 80s. And when children discovered that everything they were told about cannabis was a lie, they immediately assumed that everything they were told about heroin was a lie.
Well, the first thing to say about this is not the same cannabis that was used in the 80s. It's a different compound altogether. And maybe that wasn't a lie.
No, it's not, sir. I'm sorry. That is just incorrect.
Well, I think I just have to disagree. It's at least 20% THC, not 3%.
Could I ask where you got the information? Is the 30% of people that try cannabis become addicted to it?
Probably the best. Go to the Heritage Foundation. They have a lot of write-ups on the addictive nature, and it's in non-scientific terms.
Okay.
And check with the non-scientific study.
No, they're synthesizing scientific information. Go to the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry and search cannabis and psychosis, and you'll see these statistics.
So. Brian, thanks so much for registering your objections to that. I want to move on. You've said that people with this mutation, and going back to, help me with it, methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase?
You've got it. That's terrific.
Yeah. MTHFR.
Right.
You've said that people with this that does sound derogatory mutation. I don't
right.
know what that means.
You could say polymorphism or genetic variant.
Okay.
Because it's still
variant.
Yeah, variant.
That's
yeah,
nice.
Yeah, it's much nicer.
So they're incapable, these people, of having the right balance of neurotransmitters such as dopamine. And so
right.
they abuse opioids sometimes just to feel normal. But what does that mean? And who's to say what feels normal? Is that really more about a pain threshold? I mean,
well,
what's the bar for normal?
Yeah, that's a good idea. I think that the better way to frame it is they feel some degree of discomfort, and this makes them feel different in a euphoric way. So we know that this mutation is highly correlated with depression. So because of the lack of the neurotransmitter production. And I think that's just it. They're looking for something, and when they find this, maybe it has some temporary effect for them, but at the same time, they become addicted. And of course, it's just more gas on their fire of torment, you know.
And so we're talking then about helping people develop that right balance of neurotransmitters so that there is enough dopamine
right.
for them to feel
exactly
however they need to feel exactly. to not
well,
do that.
Well, and if you think about the antidepressants have not changed in their mechanism of action since 1959, you know. So this is the only drug therapy that's not changed since the Eisenhower administration, right? We have drugs that block the reuptake of chemicals in short supply, but they don't make the brain make more of those chemicals. You know, in fact, they kind of trick the brain into thinking there's enough serotonin out here. We can shut down the release, and that's why you hear the term Prozac poop out. You know, because Prozac worked great for 6 months, and it quit working, right? Well, it tricked the brain into thinking there was enough serotonin, so it stopped to it, we have an autoreceptor that has shut down the synthesis, right? So that's the nice thing about the natural therapies, the B vitamin therapies, is they give the brain the tools it needs to make more of the compound that's deficient. And it doesn't stop there. It's how the brain makes antioxidants. It's how the brain methylates things and turns DNA on and off. And it's how it methylates hormonal signaling. So I tell people that this theory of depression, it doesn't negate any other theory. You've heard about the monoamine hypothesis. You've been talking about serotonin. You've heard about the genetic hypothesis. You've heard about the hormonal hypothesis. This, the inflammatory process, right? This unifies all the theories. We're getting at the root cause of these illnesses when we address the genetic underpinnings.
Now, we may need to continue this into the next segment, but
sure.
I want to ask it. We have a good friend of the station, Jim, has been talking to us about spotlighting the work of Narcotics Anonymous. What role do 12-step programs play in recovery when we're talking about opiate abuse? What kind of success rate do they have? And are they underappreciated, not widely understood in terms of their work?
You know, both. I think they are underutilized, underappreciated, and we don't really have a better model. You know, though you can criticize it, you know, we have, for example, when I detox someone off heroin, there's a 94% chance they're going to relapse within 6 months. Okay, so I've done what I can do. I got them off it. We got them into a recovery program. I may even give them drugs for cravings. So we don't have the answer. I think the NA people are certainly part of the puzzle and doing good work.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. Dr. Andrew Farah, Chief of Psychiatry at the High Point Division of the University of North Carolina Healthcare System, is taking your questions and comments. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. When we come back from this short break, we'll have one more segment for you to get your question or comment in. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. One genetic mutation with a very long name, methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, could be the culprit in a host of neurodiseases, including opioid use disorder, depression, dementia, even autism. We'll
right.
get into that in a minute.
Right.
That's according to Dr. Andrew Farah, Chief of Psychiatry at the High Point Division of the University of North Carolina Healthcare System. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. It's the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. Autism? You find this genetic
right.
mutation in kids who have autism?
We do, 95% rate. Isn't that amazing? And that's just for the two major ones we test for. So there may be other subtle variants. And again, it's very, and I guess the way to circumvent it, if you can, is take an absolute, the best prenatal you can. The one is called Embrace, E-N-B-R-A-C, like Embrace HR for high-risk pregnancies. And I remember I had detoxed a young lady who was pregnant. I said, I'm going to give you the prenatal that is the best is for high-risk pregnancies and gives the baby maximum, you know, protection for the nervous system. She said, why shouldn't everybody get that? And I said, you know, you're right. They probably should. And we shouldn't just reserve it for high-risk pregnancies.
Do you give these B vitamin clusters to kids who are diagnosed with autism?
I do. And in fact, I give them to kids before I give them drugs.
And you know? Do you see any improvement in their function?
You know, it's funny. Now, with depression, you can use it as an antidepressant in kids. And that's a great idea because, you know, we know there's an increased risk of suicidal thinking with antidepressants in kids. With autism, you know, that's a little trickier because it's not one thing. You know, some kids are obsessive and some are impulsive and some are more socially awkward. You know, so as I can say that it does address some of the genetic underpinning. And for that kid, you just kind of, you know, see how it does. Is it improving their socialization, improving their spontaneity? What, you know, you just kind of have to go. I think when it comes to some of the autistic kids who have OCD, it's never been enough. I've had to add some antioxidants or something else. But again, you can use some natural therapies, and this is just a great platform to work from. Let's put it that way. Not a cure, but a platform to work from.
Going back to this idea of taking a supplement that will help the brain convert vitamin B into something that will allow it to, and tell me if I'm mischaracterizing this.
No, you've got it, yeah.
But will allow it to produce the right balance of neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin.
Right.
And antioxidants. So the people then who do have this right balance, whatever that is.
Right.
Is it possible that you could take this to the next level of human potential? I mean, what about people who are likely to overeat or gamble or overwork or oversex or play World of Warcraft too much? All the
right.
it is that, yeah. you know, is the thing that is the addiction or that consumes you or that
right.
takes you out of presence or consciousness.
Yeah, and you know, you melded some of the obsessive compulsive type behaviors and things, and that we address with the N-acetylcysteine. But you know, the good news about this agent is if you're kind of have a normal balance, let's say, of these chemicals, and you give the brain these agents, these metabolized coenzymes, these cofactors it needs, well, it doesn't. You can't get toxic in the sense that you're giving the builder raw materials. So you can give your builder lumber, but he's not going to build you a house till he has a contract and a permit and money. You know what I mean? So there's a whole series of things that go into those reactions, and there's all sorts of regulation. We're just saying, hey, here's the raw material you've been missing probably for a lifetime, and you can use it or you cannot use it depending on your need. So, so for example, if you don't have any particular depression or addiction and so forth, and you take one of these, well, you're probably protecting your brain long term. You know, you're lowering toxins in the brain, such as homocysteine and so forth, and you're, you know, protecting it from vascular damage and so forth. But you're, will it, you know, I've had people tell me, yeah, they concentrate better on it, or their eyesight gets better, you know, things like that. But you can't claim that, you know. But
do you take it?
I do, because I've done the research and I've seen the, you know, nobody wants to wind up with dementias, you know.
We have an email from Anonymous. He asks you to comment on these statements. Most addicts have a genetic disposition to addiction because of family history of alcohol or drug dependency.
We know that there's a genetic predisposition. Now, to what extent it contributes, and you know, we often screen patients that does this run in your family, so forth. And then you get in that tricky ground between learned behavior. You see dad smoking pot, you're going to smoke pot. But we know that the numbers are variable. But we can say that it's kind of a hard thing to ascribe. What percentage of an illness is genetic based? Brighter people than me say when it comes to opiates, 31% you can attribute to genetics. And that's the highest of all of the addicting compounds.
And he also asks, he writes, vitamin B therapy can be helpful in early recovery to stop craving, but long-term recovery means a lifelong commitment to complete abstinence to all drugs. Would you agree with that statement?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, you know, you hear about the methadone and Suboxone and so forth. And those are controversial, right? Because are you just prolonging the addiction? Why not just detox somebody and be done with it? And I just don't accept the premise that some people just have to be on something because they've been addicted for 6 months. Now they're fated to be on these compounds the rest of their life, you know. And so many times it just becomes another compound of abuse for these people. So, again, you were mentioning the Narcan, right? The naloxone. Well, some people feel that's emboldened. You know, that's even controversial because it emboldens people to take more risks, you know, because they know there's a reverse agent they have in their hand. So we just don't have the answer yet, do we?
And he says 12-step recovery programs offer better long-term recovery, i.e. 20-plus years clean versus church-based recovery programs. And he also says breaking the anonymity of a recovering addict is helpful to the addict, like wearing a wristband and society at large.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so those are good thoughts. You know, and again, whether one program is better than another, really it's so specific to that individual what may work for them. You just don't know.
Okay, more resistance to your statement about
sure.
marijuana.
Sure.
Melanie from Wilmington says, I was addicted to opiates for 3 years, but now kicked the habit because I had brain surgery. I do now smoke cannabis daily. I want to know what are the long-term effects of abusing opioids and using cannabis daily. How did I change psychologically, if at all?
Wow. Well, we've got to assume that the 20% THC high component of the toxin also depends on the age. The worst long-term effect you're going to see with this cannabis is going to be the cognitive decline. The loss of IQ points, decreased concentration and focus, and so forth. So over time, now you can bank on about 10 IQ points per decade. Now people don't get infinitely dumber and dumber; they kind of plateau out at low 80s. but that's been also proven. And even though people will argue with me, there's been some very long-term studies that show chronic cannabis use and decrease in cognitive abilities. And apathy, of course, lack of motivation,
Mary writes, I object to the assertion by your expert on opiates. My brother died from Xanax intoxication, a small amount of Percocet, and congestive heart failure combined with sleep apnea. He died from legally prescribed medications. I knew that there was a genetic predisposition to addiction on both sides of our family, so I haven't abused alcohol or drugs. If my brother could have just smoked marijuana and been left alone with it, he would be alive today, she writes. His anxiety and PTSD was overwhelming for him. People often self-medicate because there is a predictable outcome when they use marijuana, alcohol, even cigarettes. When it's next to impossible to get into a mental health professional, people find ways to manage their own symptoms.
Such a sad loss. What a terrible story. I'm sorry about her loss. And, she brings up the point of the combination of the opiate and the Xanax, because most of these overdoses, like the heroin and the fentanyl, because most of them with the benzodiazepine, the Xanax, the Valium, so forth, that suppresses the breathing in addition to the opiate. And, Xanax is one of the most widely prescribed drugs on the planet, and yet it has the highest seizure risk of any. There are more Xanax withdrawal seizures than all other drug-related seizures combined when people stop using it. So it's a terribly dangerous one too. Now people use it. It works for panic. It works for anxiety. But again, it's one of those that's tremendously addicting. Yeah.
Quinn from Wilmington called in and left this message reacting to your statement about Atlanta's statistic of 60% of people who are arrested have marijuana in their system. He says, Atlanta Police Force institutes racial profiling too. Thanks for sharing that sentiment, Quinn. Joshua from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Oh, me? I'm on the air right now?
Yes, you are. Hi there. Did you have a question for
our guest? Awesome. I did. My question is, do you ever feel like there's a time where marijuana is maybe could be used as a medical kind of treatment? I've seen multiple studies where like people with seizures and whatnot, where THC can kind of introduce a calming effect for
Right. The cannabinoid that has that potential is something called cannabidiol. So cannabidiol, when we actually isolate that out and give it, for example, it will treat psychosis. You can give it to schizophrenics and their hallucinations go away. The objection is that now the current plant has 0% cannabidiol in it and 85 other toxins. So we're not talking about the same thing. Whereas in the 1970s and 80s, it was 1% cannabidiol and 3% THC. So you really never saw people. You could have seen it, but it was much rarer to have a psychotic reaction or a permanent psychosis. So yes, cannabidiol would be the one that people are now studying for its medicinal purposes, but not just flat out THC.
So like a person who's I know that antidepressants come with a whole lot of side effects as well.
Right.
when you're kind of making that, I mean, is there any situation where you might suggest somebody to smoke cannabis in order to treat some kind of medical condition?
You're saying to avoid the risks of antidepressants? Is that your question? Like, really, which is higher risk, which is better?
Directly to me, whatever, I would say flat out no. You know, I would never advise anyone to use cannabis, you know, any form, mm-hmm. other than the isolated cannabidiol for a particular study, because I just...
Which is not what you would get if you buy pot on the street.
Exactly. Yeah. You're getting the toxins. But let me just explain to you, because I see every month I'm admitting young people who are now, their life is permanently changed because of this cannabis. Their brain has changed forever, mm-hmm. and I just don't want to see that if I can help it. Yeah.
Joshua.
Go ahead. I was just curious about like the use of like CBD, things that aren't.
That's it. CBD is cannabidiol. Perfect. You've got it. Yeah, you've got it.
So something
like that you would recommend to a patient, maybe?
Right now it's in study phase. You know, I might recommend it for a study for psychosis or something like that. Sure. Yeah.
Thanks so much for your question, Joshua. Good question. And we have Jeremy from Leland. Welcome to Coastline, Jeremy. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks. I appreciate it.
Sure.
Yeah, so I kind of have like a half story, half question. This is a long-time listener, first-time caller. Had a friend who lived back where I'm from in Salt Lake, and he started off on OxyContin and mixed them with cocaine. And I always told him that was like a really bad road to go down. And he always told me he was in control, and I always kind of took his word for it because he's a really smart guy. And really successful. And anyways, his wife started doing it too, and she was kind of the last person I'd ever thought would do hard drugs in any way. She was really into fitness and really into exercise and really about having her life in control. And
Jeremy, I'm sorry, we're hearing a lot of wind noise there, so can you just cut to your question? It's hard to listen.
Oh, sorry. I guess, yeah, my question is that I was just wondering, he ended up running into a friend of ours who had become addicted to heroin and was basically homeless. And he almost used it as an inspiration to switch over from OxyContin to heroin because he thought heroin would be cheaper, just because it was only like $20 per use or something like that. And I was wondering how smart people can make that rationalization.
Good question. Thank you, Jeremy.
A person addicted doesn't, you know, they don't need any. They can make whatever rationalization they want, you know, sometimes. What excuse they give to switch or use? Yeah, who knows? We just need to get them into help, get them recovery.
So we've spent this hour talking about a genetic mutation and how to help the brain produce more of its own neurotransmitters to create the right balance, so that people are less inclined to use opiates or substances that will harm them. But what role does the human soul play in all of this?
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because, you know, we spend so much time talking about hardware and we ignore the software, don't we? And the more I look into the neurochemistry and the neuroanatomy and just dissect that, the more I find it is totally inadequate. You know, this isn't the answer. You know, it's sort of, I tell people that, you know, as they're listening to us on the radio, you know, you can dissect the radio, but the message is from somewhere else. You know, the brain is just the tool, and it's the tool that communes with the transcendent. So I think that's why the recovery programs are so important and psychoanalysis is so important, because what is it about your soul, you know, that you have to find yourself in a state of derangement or be in a drug state? What is it about, you know, what's going on in your life and in your psyche that you feel this need to derange yourself, you know, as Rimbaud would say.
You even told our producer, talking about Sigmund Freud,
yes,
that he really had a beef with the way Americans interpreted psychoanalysis.
Exactly.
And part of it was just lost in translation.
Absolutely. You know, every time Freud wrote the word soul, his English translator, Strachey, put mind. And he was very unhappy that we had medicalized his beautiful soul craft. You know, he was about enriching the soul, and he thought there might be medical use for psychoanalysis, but it was really more human enrichment and societal enrichment. So imagine, of course, in Freud's time, you know, psychology was a division of philosophy. It wasn't medicalized. And he always was unhappy that we had medicalized his beautiful and elegant theories of the soul. Yeah. And he said, if it is a cure, if psychoanalysis is a cure, it's a cure, in essence, one of love. I thought that was a wonderful quote, you know.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Dr. Andrew Farah, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Production manager, Caitlin Hanrahan. Caitlin Freund is our webmaster. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at WHQR.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 2. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.